Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories podcast. I'm recording this on one of the hottest days of the year, which means there's only one seasonal film I could cover.
I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, it's given away by the title. I'm here to talk of the stories of films, and I tend to talk about production stories, marketing stories, release stories, distribution stories, all the ingredients, really, that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love, just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast, they lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I'm trying really hard not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation of just how hard it is to get a movie made. In each episode of the podcast, each regular episode, I cover two films, and I'm going to get on with the first of them, if that's all right with you. We're going back to 2018. As always, I'm going to set this up with a clip from the trailer. Come to the story. The other side of this.
We're on.
We're here to investigate a patient that killed 3 innocent teenagers on a Halloween in 1978.
He was shot by his own psychiatrist and taken into custody that night.
And has spent the last 40 years in captivity.
Hello, Michael. I have something you might like to see.
Everyone in my family like turns into a nutcase this time of year.
Yeah, I mean, your grandmother is Laurie Strode. She was almost murdered.
Wasn't it her brother who murdered all those babysitters?
No, it was not her brother. That's something that people made up.
Do you know that I pray every night that he would escape?
Who the hell did you do that for?
That then was a clip from the trailer from 2018's Halloween, directed by David Gordon Green. Screenplay credited to Jeff Fradley, Danny McBride and David Gordon Green, characters to John Carpenter and Deborah Hill, and a cast led by Jamie Lee Curtis, Judy Greer, Andy Matichach, Will Patton and Virginia Gardner. So Halloween, I mean, where do you start with this particular franchise? Deep in the 1970s, as it happened, when John Carpenter brought the original film
film to life, starring Jamie Lee Curtis. Following that, umpteen follow-ups, sequels, things going forwards and backwards. And, I mean, the number of films was heading toward, well, it was in double figures by the time we get to the end of this particular story as well. But let's pick things up with Rob Zombie. Because in 2007, Rob Zombie directed a Halloween reboot by the name of, cunningly, Halloween. And this kind of started things all over again. It wasn't a brilliant received film, but horror films often aren't brilliantly received. And it made a profit for Dimension Films, which was headed up by Bob Weinstein and had got over time a reputation for doing relatively low budget horror films. That turned in a profit. So the fact that it hadn't made $7 trillion wasn't a massive issue because it had delivered bottom line to the company. It pressed ahead very quickly with a Halloween 2, which came out in 2009. That went up against a Final Destination movie and didn't win. That particular battle didn't do particularly good box office, wasn't particularly liked, and even at the point that movie was coming out, Rob Zombie was saying he's not going to do a third film. Now, it was the Weinstein Company that owned Dimension Films, and with or without Rob Zombie, it wanted another film. That Halloween movies were, if you could turn them around once every two years, you were bringing pretty much guaranteed profit and profile into your company. And so the Weinstein Company was out of the traps really quickly by announcing that the next film would be called Halloween 3D. This made some degree of sense. 3D was the big thing in 2009. It was an easy way to add a premium to your ticket price and make even more profit for pretty much exactly the same film. It wanted Halloween 3D quickly. It quickly announced new filmmakers as well. And with the specific intention of carrying on from Rob Zombie's Halloween 2, Bloody Disgusting reported that while Halloween 2 only opened at the number 3 spot this weekend, had it not started a fist fight with the Final Destination, it would have easily taken the top spot and made over $30 million. The Weinsteins, one of those being convicted rapist Harvey Weinstein, knows this and are quickly making plans for a third film. And so the plan was press ahead, try and get that moving ideally by the end of the year. Then you could have something in cinemas, 2010, if you really got your skates on. But it wasn't a plan that was going that quickly. In fact, by the end of 2009, any idea of getting the movie going by November of that year was, well, it was done and dusted, really. The script to the film only came in at the end of September. The Weinstein Company had hired Patrick Lussier to direct, but he had a short window of opportunity to make the film because he was committed to making Drive Angry, or Drive Angry 3D, with Nicolas Cage, which started production in January 2010. Now, there was also the small matter, and Todd Farmer had been hired to write the film, coming to this shortly, but there was also the small matter of rumours suggesting the Weinstein Company was struggling for funds at this point, so it needed the film quickly, but also, could it cover all the budget for the plans of what was in the screenplay? That wasn't, well, there wasn't a definitive answer to that. The one thing we could gauge was Halloween 3D was not going into production in 2009. It thus wasn't going to be in cinemas for 2010. Bob Weinstein also was said to be worried that the production of the pre-production, the development of Halloween 3D was going too quickly. And so the company and the individuals resigned themselves to taking their place in the queue behind Drive Angry. And so Drive Angry was made. It was turned around relatively quickly. And by the middle of 2011, Halloween 3D was moving again. That Todd Farmer, who had been hired indeed to write the film for Lucio to direct, was still involved. Lucio was still involved as well. But then Dimension Films switched tack a little bit because it had announced in the trades that it was looking for Halloween 3D to now be in cinemas. 3D boom hadn't completely burst at this point by October 26th, 2012. Spoiler, that didn't happen. And so the script was being redone, and the idea was we can still get this filming ideally the end of 2011. We can have this in cinemas for Halloween. That's a good plan. However, it was also working with other horror properties, and one of those was Hellraiser. And Hellraiser had turned the head a little bit of Bob Weinstein, and also Todd Farmer and Patrick Lussier were now also on the Hellraiser film. Which of those did Dimension Films actually want to prioritise? Well, the answer to that was Hellraiser. And so with Lucier and Farmer now engaged with making a new Hellraiser film, that left personnel gap on Halloween. Who was going to fill it? Well, available and not very expensive writers. So really people who were in the early stages of their career. Ben Collins and Luke Piotrowski would talk many years later to, again, the Bloody Disgusting website, in fact, and talk about the fact that around this time, they were a pair of writers who pitched a take on Halloween. And as Collins said, we got this email saying that there was a guy from Dimension who was looking for writers for takes on both Hellraiser and Halloween. Now, Collins and Piotrowski at this stage hadn't had a production credit. They'd been pitching for a couple of years. And so that email came in, those two projects were available, and they just said it was really weird. We prepared pitches for both of them. And this was just as Blumhouse was blowing up. And I'll come to Blumhouse shortly. And so Bob Weinstein was looking, quote, at all the hits that they had and going, why aren't we making more movies? And of course, the answer was, in the opinion of Collins, he was terrible at running a company. He was bad at having opinions and giving notes, communicating with people, all that stuff. And the writers admitted that they were fresh and that they were cheap, and those qualities at that particular point in Dimension and the Weinstein Company's history, that was very helpful. And so the pitch that they did in the end for a Halloween film was to go right the way back to the very first movie. A prescient pitch this turned out to be. And they came up with an idea that again had this iconic horror character Michael Myers back where he was in the first movie, not even called Michael Myers. And it was a phone pitch that they put in. It didn't go particularly well. They didn't get the gig. And so, I mean, time just continued to pass, really, and there wasn't a solution. There wasn't the eureka idea to move Halloween forward. It did seem to be coming clear that a break with the Rob Zombie films was now looking more likely. And at one stage, there was an idea to revive really an old script that would have followed on from 2002's Halloween movie, Halloween Resurrection, which was the last time Jamie Lee Curtis had appeared in the franchise. Still, though, there wasn't a clear path forward. But what had, as Collins and Piotrowski had suggested, what had really reframed all of this in the minds of Dimension Films was the success of 2010's Paranormal Activity, the micro-budget horror movie that, I mean, it just cost, in Hollywood terms, pennies and had turned into a nine-figure massive success. It had also, in turn, revived the idea of found footage horror, which had come to the fore prominently in 1999's The Blair Witch Project and hadn't really gone away. But there wasn't a massive found footage success again until 2010's Paranormal Activity, and the profits that were rolling in for that film, well, I mean Dimension Films wanted some of that. And also, why couldn't Halloween do something like that? That was kind of part of the thinking. And so we got to Halloween 3D suddenly coming back into the frame, and this would have been not just a 3D movie, but a found footage Halloween film. And a script this time was put together that had a little bit of a lighter and self-referential tone for it. That there's talk of it being almost like a kind of mockumentary. But that didn't go down particularly well either, that it wasn't really convincing the invested parties that that's the way you go forward with a new Halloween film. And this franchise just continued to lumber in some degree of limbo. In fact, we get now to 2014, and Halloween at this stage has been off the big screen for 5 years, which is the gap between 2002's Halloween Resurrection and the first of the Rob Zombie movies. And so Scout Taylor Compton, in 2014, who at that point was the incumbent Laurie Strode, this key character in the Halloween movies, took to Twitter, back when it was called Twitter, to confirm, hang on, she was returning. They were going to make a new Halloween film. It looked in 2014 that all of a sudden we were going to get a Halloween 3 in whatever form that was, even if no filmmakers were known to be attached at this stage. So 2014 went on, and then 2015 follows. It's a radical story, this, but by 2015, whatever this new Halloween film was had changed again, because this point it was going to be a standalone movie. It wasn't going to connect to those Rob Zombie films after all. And now Patrick Melton and Marcus Dunstan were hired at the start of 2015 to write a new film called Halloween Returns. Now, Melton and Dunstan had enjoyed success with an assortment assortment of Saw movies, and with them on board writing a new script, the idea was, let's get Halloween Returns filming in July 2015. All concerned got so confident with the project that Dimension Films put out a statement. And in it, Bob Weinstein, co-chairman of the Weinstein Company and Dimension Films, was quoted as saying, Michael Myers has taken a long break from the big screen and we know fans are eager to see him return. We are excited to be back in business with Trancos and look forward to bringing one of the scariest installments of this classic franchise to audiences worldwide. The Trancos, in this case, is the production company behind the Halloween movies. We were also told in that same statement the plot for what Halloween Returns was going to be. And the synopsis read as follows. Halloween Returns will be a standalone film set to reintroduce audiences to Michael Myers years after his initial rampage. It will pit a new group of Haddonfield youngsters against Myers. The now 18-year-old child of one of Myers' victims plays a central role, along with the child of a cop who's long been obsessed with Myers' case, even putting it before his own daughter. Myers is now on death row, and the two kids, with their own personal vendettas against the killer, sneak in to watch his execution. But when things go awry, wouldn't you know it, when things go awry, Myers escapes, and the pair, along with their friends, find themselves in the firing line. Now, what was unknown when that statement came out was that the Weinstein Company and Dimension Films was against the clock to get a Halloween film going. Perhaps that's why the statement came out when things weren't quite as ready to go as they might have appeared. Because in order to retain the rights to the Halloween saga and continue its rights to make the films, it apparently had to have a film go into production before the end of 2015. Now, circumstances just piled up against that as well, and it became clear as delays came in that a 2015 production schedule was just looking too difficult. And in the end, the Weinstein Company and Dimension Films, and this was before all the revelations about Harvey Weinstein, it had to admit defeat. It ran out of time, and the news broke in December 2015 that the film was no longer happening. Bloody disgusting it was, again, who uncovered the fact that the rights had now gone back to Miramax. Now, Miramax was the original company, of course, that the Weinsteins had set up. Then Miramax was sold to Disney. Then the Weinsteins left Disney. And by this point, Miramax had been sold to a third-party investment group and was going back up for sale. So in spite of having deals with the company through the Weinstein Company, it's quite confusing, isn't it? The Weinsteins no longer had anything to do with Miramax. And by the middle of 2015, the company was actually in the hands of a firm called the Bein Media Group that had in turn, God, this is hurting my head, that had in turn spun out of the Al Jazeera television network. And so at the point it had got its hands on Halloween, it was looking to make the most of the new assets that it had managed to acquire. Now, it was then in May 2016 that a producer and an occasional guest on this podcast by the name of Jason Blum entered the conversation. That Miramax in 2016, I'm coming to how it happened just shortly, struck a deal with Blumhouse to make a new Halloween film as a co-production. And a man by the name of Mike Flanagan, now, I mean, revered, particularly for his Netflix horror shows as well, has been sounded out about directing at this point. And again, haste was in place. In May 2016, the plan was to get the film out in October 2017, but Flanagan and Halloween never ultimately came together. Hopes have been raised about the revival of Halloween, though, by the return of the creator of the series, John Carpenter, because in 2016, he was brought back as executive producer, and he was saying all of the right things as well. Now, Carpenter hadn't been shy about allowing remakes and extensions of his assorted films, and why not? He created them. Why not take the fruits of them much further down the line? But The Guardian quoted him as saying, 38 years after the original Halloween, I'm going to help to try to make the 10th sequel the scariest of them all. So it was still Miramax, but at this point a director hadn't been found to steer the film forward. But what had brought all this together, the eureka moment if you like, was a conversation with Malik Ackard. Now Malik Ackard owned part of the rights to Halloween, and his father had produced lots of the films, and Ackard just hadn't been particularly happy with the direction the movies had been going. There was some dissatisfaction really with what Rob Zombie had done with the series. John Carpenter wasn't a fan of what Rob Zombie had done with the series apparently too. too. And so it was Zan Devine at Miramax who she decided to go and have a conversation with Malik Akkad to try and just kind of unpick all the rights and all of this. And the conversation was that frustration that they just had, the films just hadn't been good enough. And it was from there that Zan Devine had the idea of getting Blumhouse involved. And the call thus went into Blumhouse. And Jason Blum, whenever he's doing a, he's talked about this, whenever he's doing a sequel and wherever he's doing a remake or something like that, he wants to go back to the original creators as much as he could. So Jason Blum had the idea, let's get John Carpenter back. And as he would describe to Deadline, I had a 15-minute meeting with John. I pitched my heart out and he seemed unimpressed. And he said at the very last minute, I said, look, John, they are going to do this sequel no matter what. And if you're out, I'm out. So why not this time, instead of grouching from the sidelines, join me and we'll try and make it great. And Carpenter looked at him, scowled and said, I'm in. And that's what unlocked it. This is why it was happening. I mean, the film was going to be frugal. $10 million budget was agreed. I mean, the first Halloween had cost a few thousand dollars. And you look at a filmmaker like Ben Wheatley, most recently directing the Meg sequel, and the way he stacks his career is he figures as long as he's always got $6,000-$8,000 in the bank, he can go back to the original Halloween and just get some kind of film made. So inspired was he by not just the original movie, but the frugalness of it, of how Carpenter managed to make such an effective film on such a slight budget. Now, of course, this was decades further on, so $10 million was a lot more money on paper. It wasn't much in the scheme of contemporary filmmaking. Blumhouse and Miramax were going to split the budget. A conversation took place with Adam Wingard about possibly directing the film. And in fact, he had conversation with John Carpenter about it. And John Carpenter sent him a really lovely note. And Wingard just kind of reconciled, it ain't going to get much better than that, and elected not to direct the film. And then the announcement in 2017 came that the personnel had been secured. And so the two people who were going to write were David Gordon Green and Danny McBride. And so a little bit of a surprise here. Danny McBride, best known for his comedy work. That's where most people knew him from. David Gordon Green's career is really interesting, I think, because he broke through with the hugely acclaimed George Washington in 2000, a drama that like got a Criterion Collection DVD release. Then you move on like 7-8 years and he's making comedies such as Pineapple Express and Your Highness. And then you move on a bit forward and he makes a terrific Nicolas Cage film called Joe. He does a big studio movie, Ad Brandy's Crisis, which didn't do particularly well, but showed kind of the range really of the stuff that he was tackling. And at the point he was being sounded out to do Halloween, he directed a film called Stronger, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, which is basically it's a biopic of Jeff Borman and a man who lost his legs in the Boston Marathon. And so this was another change of direction for him. And I mean, he was seen as a surprising choice. There wasn't much in his back catalogue that screamed horror. Certainly wasn't much in Danny McBride's that screamed horror. And yet, what they opted to do, first of all, they opted to sign on the dotted line. They were going to do this. They were keen to do this. And they wanted to do something which was being talked about as a bit of a trend, really, which was ignore all but the first two films in the saga. So Neil Blomkamp tried to get an Alien film moving, you might recall, once upon a time, where the plan was, I'm going to ignore everything from Alien 3 onwards, and then I will make a film that continues from there. Superman Returns did a similar thing, ignoring Superman 3 and 4, and just followed on from Superman 2. There's been talk of a RoboCop film that just basically follows on from the first film directly and ignores the sequels that it didn't like. And so there was a little bit of that, appreciating that the Halloween saga is all over the place just in terms of its narrative and timelines. There was a little bit of that thinking with Halloween. Carpenter was keen on this as well. Again, he wasn't a fan of the Rob Zombie movie, and the idea of going back to the original Final Girl, Laurie Strode, well, that was interesting as well, but could they get Jamie Lee Curtis involved? Well, the answer to that was very much a yes, and in September 2017, with a big statement of intent, Jamie Lee Curtis was back in the Halloween saga for the first time for, 15, 16 years by the time the movie hit the big screen. The plan then was get this in front of the cameras in October 2017, then it would be in cinemas for October 2018. The cast coming together, Judy Greer signing up, Nick Castle back to play Michael Myers as well, although it was almost like a bit of a passing of the torch that Myers was also played by James Duke Courtney in the film too. The problem, though, that they hit was the start of production ended up delayed, that they pushed it back to the middle of January 2018. Now, the reasoning behind this was never really announced, but the suspicion was that all of the cast wasn't fully in place. They got the lead sorted, of course, but what about the extras, the supporting artists and people such as that as well? And so in the end, there were casting notes put out around South Carolina where the film was going to shoot. And this kind of just contributed to the idea that the casting wasn't quite completed. Still, filming did get underway January the 13th, 2018, a brand new Halloween movie. The first one to shoot for nearly 10 years at this point. I mean, the Rob Zombie movie had been 9 years previous at this stage. They were in the South Carolina area. They were looking to capture the neighbourhood feel of the original movie. And in fact, the touch point for David Gordon Green throughout was going back to what made that first Halloween film work. That the emphasis was much more on building tension than outright blood and guts. That they were looking to that first film as a touch point, really. And I mean, it was a brisk shoot. There wasn't an awful lot of drama to report during the filming of it. That by the end of February, Halloween 2018 was pretty much in the can. And without the requirement for post-production special effects in any great number, a cut was ready in a matter of, what, two, three months. So then they test screened the film, and it had already been known that they put aside just a few extra days to do some pickup shots and some reboot work that would take place in the summer of 2018. And so after the test screening, they did indeed decide they were just going to do a little bit of tuning and reworking of the ending. And so they went back to South Carolina in June 2018. They brought extras back in. They brought some of the key cast back in, got the extra footage that they needed. But confidence was very much on the up with this Halloween movie. That, I mean, Dimension and Blumhouse were co-funding it, but then it had brought in Universal Pictures as a distribution partner, that Universal would pay a distribution fee and then take its slice. And so it was Universal that debuted the first trailer for the film at the film convention, in an industry event really that took place in April of 2018, and the response to it was really, really strong. And then they took it to Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con, in July 2018. Along went Jamie Lee Curtis, and I mean, that's when more footage was shown. It was really going across well, and there was a feeling, might they just have something here? Might this really, really work? Well, they weren't going to have to wait an awful lot longer to find out, because predictably enough, the new Halloween movie was ready and heading to release in October 2018. That Universal would stump up around $70-80 million just to promote the film. It's an important number, this, because that's what, 7-8 times the production budget of the film. Now, if you go back to filmmaker Kevin Smith, when he took his journey into horror with his first horror movie, Red State, he made a point about the distribution of that film and how the distribution model of movies was just completely messed up, that he could make a film for $5 million, but it would cost $40 million to release it. The cost of going through traditional distribution was just off the chart. And that was certainly the case in the case of Halloween, where it was going to cost the best part of $100 million to release a $10 million film. Thankfully, they had people on their side, because they took the first public screening to the Toronto International Film Festival in September 2018. And the response, and remember, the Rob Zombie films hadn't gone down particularly well. The response to the movie was really, really strong. This is a Halloween film that came out post the Me Too Me Too revelations and the generation of the Me Too movement as well. And it was well regarded, first of all, for getting rid of all the stuff that had bogged down some of the later movies that hadn't been particularly appreciated. And then for his Jamie Lee Curtis headlining this horror movie and putting in a performance and a half, really. Horror movies get mixed reviews anyway. And there's a reason this Halloween film gets mixed reviews too. It has its ups, it has its ups and downs, but when it works, it really, really, really works. Would audiences turn up? Boy, did audiences turn up. That Universal put the movie out in American cinemas the weekend of October the 19th to the 21st, and it opened to an astonishing $76.2 million. It was record-breaking. There had never been a film in the history of movies, headlined by a woman over 55, that had made anywhere close to that kind of opening weekend number. Jamie Lee Curtis was a woman who has studiously celebrated and been the heartbeat of so many genre films, was now, for this weekend, the biggest box office star in the world. It was absolutely wonderful to see. Really, really something. And, you know, the film continued to do well. I mean, it's worth noting that that opening weekend, it did have a relatively clear run. That A Star Is Born was still around. That was doing all right on week three. That was the number two movie with $19 million. So Halloween was top of the chart by a lot. Venom had come out 2 weeks before, $18 million. Goosebumps 2, not as good as Goosebumps 1, sadly. That had been out the week before, $9 million in fourth place. First Man, underrated movie, $8 million in fifth place. Halloween predictably lost a good chunk of its business the following weekend, but not as much as you might think, not least because we're coming into Halloween weekend. It lost 58% of its business, was still number one by a lot, $31 million against A Star Is Born's $14 million. The other openers against it that weekend were Hunter Killer, starring Gerard Butler. That's a pretty good film, that, as well. And then, how's this for a Halloween film? Johnny English Strikes Again opened in America. Opened in 12th place with $1.6 million. They're making Johnny English 4 at the point this is being recorded. It would be the following week, with Halloween in the rearview mirror, that Bohemian Rhapsody came out. $51 million knocked Halloween off the top of the charts. The Nutcracker and The Four Realms came out with $20 million as well. Nobody's Fool with $13. Halloween was down to fifth, but by the time it completed its US release, it had done $159 million. It had added $96 million outside of the US as well. And eyes were opened, wide, wide opened. This is how you go back to a pre-existing horror franchise and do something that recaptures audiences. And so, I mean, what Blumhouse really did was they got the golden goose and decided to do two sequels back to back. We got Halloween Kills in 2021. We got Halloween Ends in 2022. Both of them simultaneously released on streaming services in the US as well, at the point of being cinemas, both of which nowhere near as well received as Halloween 2018, both of which still made a lot of money. And it kind of set a template, really, for Blumhouse in particular, in going back and getting the rights to the Exorcist films, with the idea of doing three Exorcist movies with some of that Halloween team. That didn't quite go to plan, but hey, that's a story for another episode of Film Stories. Which brings me to the halfway point of this episode. And as always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. I'm just going to do a couple of parish notices just in this halfway point. If you like this podcast, first and foremost, then first of all, thank you so much for lending it your ears. There are a couple of other ways you can support it if you're so inclined to do so. First of all, costing you absolutely nothing, is to subscribe to the podcast at your podcast home of choice. That is hugely appreciated and helps with algorithms and things like that that I don't fully understand. Likewise, if you can leave a review, ideally a hugely positive review, that would be great. That's also much appreciated. If you're inclined to put money into the Film Stories project, then God bless you. If you go to patreon.com/SimonBrew and put some coins in the pot there, you get the podcast early and ad-free pretty much every week. You also find out the gossip of what we're up to behind the scenes. And so that's over at patreon.com/SimonBrew. And then I've got print magazines. I'm about to announce day or two after this podcast goes out, issue 50 of Film Stories magazine, an independent film print magazine, the UK's biggest at 168 pages, is now up to issue 50. I'm knackered. 50 issues of it. You can find it at store.filmstories.co.uk. And I've just revealed issue 17 of Film Junior magazine, a print film magazine for youngsters, partly written by them. Thanks so much to the director of the Garfield movie, Mark Dindal. Thank you so much to John Krasinski for sparing time to talk to young reporters in that issue. You can find those for sale at store.filmstories.co.uk. But I think that's enough parish notices. I'm going to move on with the second of the two films I'm talking about in this episode of Film Stories. I'm going to do another sequel as well, another entry in a long-running franchise. This one didn't quite go to plan, though. We'll come to the story the other side of this clip.
From a million to one shot, he became a true champion of the world. Now, the glory.
Because of the continuous violent blows to the head, the effects are irreversible.
The crowds.
My husband is retired. He has nothing more to prove.
And the money are gone.
You lost millions.
Look, I still got my place in the old neighborhood.
His title is in the hands of a new champion.
He might win a few fights, but he's no Rocky Balboa.
Controlled by an unscrupulous promoter.
This is your medical report. It's not so good, but we can work around it.
All that's left is his family.
We've been down before. I'll get it all back.
His heart.
I gotta fight, okay? I got problems, I gotta fight.
And a dream. A dream to get it all back.
This is a tremendous opportunity.
Opportunity for who? For you to make money, for him to be disabled?
That then was a clip from Rocky V, directed by John G. Avildsen, written by Sylvester Stallone, and starring Sylvester Stallone, Talia Shire, Burt Young, Sage Stallone, Tommy Morrison, and Burgess Meredith. Now, to start the story of Rocky V, it's worth going back to the filmography of the person behind it, Sylvester Stallone, the creator of Rocky, one of the most famous rags-to-riches stories in all of Hollywood, the person who, for 1976's Rocky, just gambled everything on being allowed to take the lead role and it paying off handsomely and building him a career. Now, the interesting thing about Rocky films is where they sit within Sylvester Stallone's career, because at points where he was in lulls, and I think it's fair to say his career's had some highs and lows over the years, he could always reach for a Rocky. So in 1976, he broke through with Rocky. Then he made Fist, or F-I-S-T, Paradise Alley. Neither of those particularly made box office gold. So then he did Rocky II. After that, he does Nighthawks and Escape to Victory. Neither of those go particularly mad, although a lot of time for Escape to Victory. So he does Rocky III. After that, he has more joy with the first Rambo film, First Blood, but then staying alive, he has, he doesn't have a massive success with Rhinestone. He certainly doesn't. So in 1985, he does two sequels. He does Rambo First Blood Part 2, big success, Rocky IV, one of the finest films of the 1980s. How does he follow it up? Well, Cobra didn't do great. Over the Top didn't do great. Rambo 3, at one point the most expensive film of all time, underperformed at the box office, still did decent money. Lock Up with Donald Sutherland, the hugely underappreciated Tango and Cash. But so, I mean, there's some modest successes in this, but nothing really huge. And so it was time, really, to go for another Rocky. This in a period of Stallone's career where he was just looking for a change, not the same old action roles that really altered to a degree how he approached this fifth Rocky film, but also the two films he'd pick afterwards. He'd lean towards comedy in the ill-fated Oscar in 1991 and Stop or My Mom Will Shoot in 1992 before going back to action with Cliffhanger, covered before on the podcast in 1993. For the purposes of Rocky V, though, this would follow, 5 years after the much, much loved Rocky IV? And for Stallone, really, he just wanted to do something a bit different. This was the time to go a bit more back to basics risks with it all. He wanted to go back to the earth and the grit of the original Rocky film. And he got to a point where he thought, well, maybe I'm not the person to direct this one as well. And so it was really, I mean, the first signs I could find of it in terms of Hollywood trade press were in 1988, but it was in 1989 really where this was really coming together, where Stallone had his script in place, or at least had a script that he could pursue. MGM keen to make the film. MGM ultimately the arbiters of this. Stallone may have written Rocky and created the character, but he had sold the rights. This has come up relatively recently in Instagram posts that he's made over the ownership of Rocky and Creed. But in the late 1980s, he was inclined to make another Rocky film, and he was inclined to bring this more back to basics, really. So, I mean, he needed a foe for a start. And in 1989, a boxer by the name of Tommy the Duke Morrison was a successful heavyweight. I think he was 20 at the time. And he was in line for the role of Tommy Gunn in the movie, with the villain of the piece, really. He would land that role. And the thinking there was, it's easier to get a boxer and teach them to act than get an actor and teach them to box. Now, there's been differing approaches to boxers on film over the years. You look at what happened with Robert De Niro and Raging Bull, where he method acted a lot. The level of preparation was incredible on that film. So it is possible to get an actor to box, a boxer to act. Well, this was going to be a bit of a stretch. And so it was decided to bring in drama coaches, understandably so, to help Tommy Morrison prepare for this. Morrison understood what a big job this, you know, what a big opportunity this was. And so the drama coaches were Richard and Leslie Brander. They worked with him as he prepared for the role, because there was some concern he wouldn't be able to manage this. This came from director. This came from some of the studio people as well, apparently. But, I mean, to the delight, really, of people, the progress that Morrison made was quick. And it was getting to the point where it was not only they thought he could pull the role off, but also Stallone, impressed by his upcoming co-star, reportedly rewrote his screenplay a little bit, just to bring more out of the character of Morrison. He just felt he could trust him with more of the film. Now, as always, there were other casting rumours around Rocky V. There was talk that high-profile boxers Frank Bruno and Evander Holyfield might be appearing in the film. Both were apparently offered roles in Rocky V. In the case of Evander Holyfield, the story goes, I've not asked him face-to-face, was that he was offered a role of a boxer who wouldn't win a bout. And Holyfield at this stage in his career had never lost. And so even in fiction, he didn't want to put across the impression that he would lose a boxing match. Now, this back to basics approach, particularly after the gloss of Rocky IV, I mean, how do you heighten that anymore? It was, if I'm going to go back to basics, if I'm going to go back to really the heart of where this all started, I'm also going to go back to the original director of the film, John G. Avildsen, who directed the original Rocky film. Now, as Avildsen would tell the outlet Mandatory back in 2014, he read the script and he said it was a terrific story, a great script. And he revealed, we're doing spoilery a bit on this, but I don't think it's a massive spoiler given that the franchise has continued. Rocky died at the end of Rocky V in the script that Avildsen had read. And as he described in this interview, he had this devastating fight with Tommy Gunn, the name of the character that Tommy Morrison was playing, ends up in an ambulance with his head in Adrian's lap, Adrian being his wife, of course, and by the time they get to the hospital, he's dead. Adrian comes out of the hospital and there's the world's press assembled, and as Avildsen described it, she announced that Rocky is dead, but as long as people believe in themselves, Rocky's spirit will live forever. And John G. Avildsen thought, yeah, that's what a beautiful way to end the series. And going into Rocky V, that was the thinking. This is going to be the end of the franchise. It is going to be the final Rocky film. Now, they've said this before, but they've said it since. But this was very much the intent going in. And Avildsen said, yeah, he would make it on those terms. And he would describe how the ending that was put to him was the reason he signed up to do the film in the first place. Now, it was coming together relatively quickly now. Sage Stallone, Sylvester's son, was cast as Rocky Jr. Sage passed a few years ago, tragically. He wasn't even a teenager, the character of the son in the film. And so some continuity problems, as many have pointed out, sprung up in Rocky V, given that the script that Sylvester Stallone had written picked up immediately after the ending, really, of Rocky IV, and took things from there, yet everyone looked older and people had jumped ages and stuff like that. That notwithstanding, is the movies. We can take a leap of faith. That was the thinking. Burgess Meredith's character as well had passed earlier in the Rocky series, but the actor agreed to come back to film some extra scenes for Rocky V. Characteristic to the saga, there were going to be flashbacks. Who could have seen that coming in a Rocky movie? And at the start of January 1990, filming was ready to go, and there was kind of a sense of homecoming for it. The filming began on the 15th of January of 1990. The film was going to be out at the end of the year. MGM was putting forward the money for it. And as the New York Times reported in January 1990, when the Sylvester Stallone was going back to Philadelphia for the film, that Rocky Balboa, a character from Philadelphia, and the Times report said he began filming Rocky V here last week. He roused the city from its January white sails. But instead of playing to the crowd when Rocky V was shooting in and around the area, Stallone was more concerned with crowd control at his sets. And he's been secretive about the film's plot and location. So there was a veil of secrecy over the film, presumably because of the intent to end with the demise of Rocky Balboa. And so as much as bits of it were being filmed out in the open, it was a case of trying to keep as much under wraps as possible. Now, it was a taxing production for Talia Shire, reprising the role of Adrian in the movie, because she was also making another film that was set to end a particular saga. Francis Ford Coppola had finally got The Godfather Part 3 going. That was going to be out at the end of 1990 as well. Parts of that were filming in Rome, as you would expect from a Godfather film. And so Talia Shire was wanted on The Godfather Part 3 and on Rocky 5 at the same time. And so she was going between the two locations, a lot of long-haul flights, and by the sounds of it, a very, very exhausting schedule just to be able to keep her appearances in both of those particular films. In terms of other elements of Rocky, I mean, there's the story of the iconic Rocky Balboa statue, a film prop, as Philadelphia authorities noted, which was moved back to the location where it had been removed from. It was moved back to the steps outside, I believe it's the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Also, locations from the original Rocky film were being sought and used for the film, but you know, there was all that fan interest around it as well, and it was quite hard for the bits of the, I mean, it's a location shoot and people were familiar with the locations, really, and so they had to fight through a fair amount of crowds. Sylvester Stallone, at this point, one of the biggest movie stars in the world, here he was back in town with arguably his biggest franchise, and so it was always going to attract interest. And there were points where that was really useful as well, because there was a fight sequence shot at Philadelphia City Civic Center in early February 1990 that required tens of thousands of extras in the crowd. And this is the era where if you wanted the appearance of lots of people in the crowd, generally the easiest way was to put lots of people in the crowd. Now, there was a film that came out, I think it was about a year or two later, a film called The Babe, starring John Goodman, which never got a cinema release over here. The biopic of Babe Ruth, the baseball player, for those in America, it sounds like I'm talking down to you know this, of course. Most of you in Britain probably know it. The important part of that movie was it was one of the first films to digitally recreate segments of a crowd, to use a computer to make a crowd look a bit bigger. Now, Rocky V couldn't do that, and so it needed lots and lots of extras. And, of course, the pulling power of a Rocky film, the pulling power of Sylvester Stallone, meant you got lots and lots of extras. That was fine. Filming wrapped up after, it's only around 6 weeks. It wasn't the longest of shoots, really. There was a little bit of legal argy-bargy afterwards that, as the Los Angeles Times reported in 1990, two stuntmen who were injured during the shooting of Rocky V filed suit in Los Angeles Superior Court against the producers of the film and actors Sylvester Stallone and Tommy Morrison. Now, the two stunt performers, Steve Santasuso of Glendale and Todd Champion of West Covina, as the report notes again, contend they were hurt in fight scenes designed to capture authentic knockouts on film, and their attorney was not particularly happy with this. The injuries were allegedly a breaking of jaw in two places and a cheekbone being fractured, and the pair asked for $20 million in compensation for the injuries sustained on the film. Now, this is a 1990 legal case, so I couldn't find any evidence of the conclusion of it. I would bet the best part of $20 million that the two didn't get $20 million out of the production. I'm not assigning guilt or anything like that. I just don't think they got that much money. The interesting thing about the suit as well, though, there was a little just bit of film trivia in it, because it argued in the lawsuit that Sylvester Stallone directed the fight scenes in Rocky V rather than John G. Avildsen. Now, this was very, very strongly denied by the producers of the film. And so, but it's the only time I see that rumour come up. But it's the kind of like the easy kind of tittle-tattle, really. But that was something that was put into the legal documentation. Further, in fact, on Rocky V, further legal action would follow a year or two later as well. I'm jumping forward a little bit, but a man called Joey Barnum sued Sylvester Stallone. And I mean, I'm quoting a newspaper report saying a boxer turned writer whose story served as the basis for the 1959 CBS movie The Killer Instinct says that he, and not Sylvester Stallone, provided the basis for the movie Rocky V. And Joey Barnum alleged, again in Superior Court lawsuit, that he gave an updated, I'm quoting, so don't sue me, an updated 1989 version of his story, which he said he'd given to Sylvester Stallone's mother and brother, and quote, it served as the template for the basic plot, themes and principal characters of the movie. Again, I don't know if it was successful. I don't know how much money was involved in that, but it's one of those things where you've got a big Hollywood production anyway, they tend to be a magnet for assorted legalities. Again, I'm not taking sides. I'm too poor to be in this fight at all. After the initial shoot had been completed for Rocky V, question marks over the ending were ongoing. These were ongoing throughout the production as well, that there was disagreement over should Rocky Balboa die at the end of the film. MGM really wasn't keen on this at all. Now, it couldn't make a future Rocky film without Sylvester Stallone, so it didn't particularly want to cheese him off, but also it just closed everything off for good, and MGM didn't want this. And over at the really excellent Total Rocky website, there's an interview there with John G. Avildsen, and he goes back to the point about when I read that, I said, what a great way to go out, what a beautiful ending. And Avildsen said, so we started shooting the movie, and a couple of weeks into the shooting, I get a call from the head of the studio, and they say, by the way, Rocky's not going to die. Batman doesn't die. Superman, James Bond, these people don't die. Leaves pause. The ending would be changed, and there was a real feeling that it took away from what the film could have been. I've got no idea in the end if an ending was shot where Rocky Balboa did indeed die. I don't know if those scenes were in the can at any point, but the ending was going to be changed, and the reason Avildsen had signed on, he was reportedly not happy at all. He passed a few years ago, so it's quite hard to give you any more detail on that, that there were reports at the point he completed his cut, he pretty much walked away. But again, I've only got a single source on those. One thing that was known was that the film had changed cinematographer during production, that Steve Poster had been the DP, and artistic differences were cited really over him leaving the project. It was believed to be over how the film was being lit, that it came back as well to this thing that Avildsen wanted that rawer style from the original film, almost like a cheaper looking, not in a cheap and nasty kind of way, but just something a little bit more down to earth. And so it was said to have been a little bit to and fro over that. Nothing nasty. It was creative, artistic differences. The film was originally, apparently as well, going by the title of Rocky the Final Bell. It wasn't just that Rocky Balboa was going to die. It was they were putting it into the title that this was the last movie. Now, anyone who's watched a horror film knows that as soon as someone tells you it's the last movie, the general rule of thumb is it's not the last movie. But for a drama, that was slightly different. And so there was a finality to this as they were coming towards the release, towards the end of 1990. And I mean, it was going to be a very big film. It was a huge deal that Stallone was coming in to end the Rocky saga. The film was costing $42 million to make as well. I mean, by the scheme of Rocky films, this was when you consider it's like a 6-week shoot, this was a really expensive film to make by the standards of them. Rocky IV had cost a reported $28 million. Rocky III, $17 million. I mean, if you really want to go to Rocky II as well, that was, what, $7 million. The first Rocky was made for next to peanuts. Even Rocky Balboa, that will ultimately follow on, was made for $24 million. So of the mainline Rocky films, Rocky V was the most expensive. Much of that down to Stallone's salary, of which I've seen mixed reports. Some say $15 million, others say up to $25 million. But it was a relatively modest shoot based around a huge star salary. That much seems relatively clear. And as much as John G. Avildsen was directing the film, Stallone clearly had his input as well. I mean, Avildsen was editing as well with Michael New. And the post-production turned out to be something of a bit of a squeaky bum time, to use football parlance, when it came to the final deadline, because the very first screening of the film was set for the start of November 1990. But, I mean, as early as 8 days before, it just wasn't ready. And this was in the 35mm era of film. I talk about this a lot. In the era of digital distribution, you are pushing your luck if you only finish your film like 4 or 5 days before it's due in cinemas. But at least there's a way you can get it around. Here you had to strike at prints, you had to load them into cans, you had to distribute them around the country, and it just wasn't locked. And the reason it wasn't locked was the sound. I mean, Bill Conti was coming back and doing the score, but it was to do with a song that was being recorded especially for the film called The Measure of a Man that Elton John was recording. And Alan Menken, one of the writers on that song, who by this point had picked up an Oscar for The Little Mermaid. And it was only once this song, The Measure of a Man, was ready could the final sound mix be concluded. And the film was ready just days before that first screening. The assumption was, though, again, this was one of the biggest films of the end of 1990. Put it alongside The Godfather Part 3. This was expected to be huge until people saw it. And, I mean, Rocky V's reviews were, as much as Sylvester Stallone was in line for a kicking, I think it's worth acknowledging that, Rocky V's reviews were really poor. I mean, there were a couple who really loved it. I mean, it's noted that the Los Angeles Times really came out swinging for it, for instance. And the reviews at the time weren't as bad as they've gone on to be for the film. Sometimes a film comes out and it's looked at in more affectionate eye, with more affectionate eyes going forward, something like Star Trek V, for instance. In the case of Rocky V, I don't think that's happened. And it just didn't feel, as much as it was going back to the original style of Rocky I, it didn't really capture the feel of it. It just didn't feel like it worked. And so the reviews for the film were coming in at best okay, at worst this isn't very good. And it was quite crushing, really. That, and Stallone, over time, has talked about it a lot, about how he regrets the film and what they got wrong. But still, going into its release in the US on November the 16th, 1990, it was that weekend, 16th to the 18th, big things were expected of the film. The problem was, it opened opposite Home Alone. And Home Alone had, its opening weekend of Home Alone was $17 million, which was, you know, good, above expectation, but Home Alone would go on to be an absolute juggernaut that particular Christmas. Rocky V, a more expected big hit, opened with $14 million. Again, no massive alarm bells there. $14 million in second place. Child's Play 2 was in third place. That had been number one the week before. The Rescuers Down Under hadn't opened well for Disney. Ghost was hanging around after 19 weeks. Jacob's Ladder, Reversal of Fortune, which would have a good Oscar run. Carl Reiner's Sibling Rivalry, White Palace, really underrated film there. Quigley Down Under as well, I just want to mention, was in 10th place. This is Quigley Down Under is worth seeking out because it is the other Alan Rickman villain performance that just isn't really talked about. As much as people talk about his work in Die Hard and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, he gave another villainous performance in Quigley Down Under, and it's a really good Western as well. The problem for Rocky V is its second week wasn't good. Its takings were down 45%. Now, in the 80s and 90s, that's very bad. Now it's fairly commonplace, but the expectation was your audience would build. As an example, Home Alone's audience on its second weekend grew 22%. The Rescuers Down Under grew 25%. Dances with Wolves was just opening up at that point, and its audience had grown. Three Men and a Little Lady opened in second place with $13 million. Rocky Five, though, was already down to fifth place with $7.7 million on its second weekend. Predator 2 had opened and knocked it down. That had opened in fourth place. And Rocky Five just continued to tumble. It was down 57% the week after as Misery opened up in second place with $10 million. Home Alone still at the top of the chart. And as we headed towards the lucrative Christmas period, Rocky Five was losing its screens that cinemas were going for films that just offered a better return. Edward Scissorhands opened on a couple of screens the start of December. That would expand and go well. Look Who's Talking 2 opened by mid-December as Rocky V dropped out of the top 10 altogether as films, again, Home Alone, absolutely just entrenched at the top of the chart. And, I mean, it was all building up to Kindergarten Cop coming out and not doing great, The Godfather 3 coming out and not doing as well as had been expected. Rocky V, though, was a sizable disappointment. I mean, there was no way around it. As much as the ambition of it was sound, the idea of doing something that bit more down to earth, by the time it left American cinemas, $40 million in the bank, well down on the money we'd seen on Rocky IV. And the Stallone name still carried it around the world. It did another $80 million outside of America. So $120 million. No one made a loss on Rocky V. It continues to sell. Avildsen put out there's a director's cut of his actually around as well. But compare that to Rocky IV, which had made $300 million worldwide in the mid-1980s. That's like Avatar now. It's not quite like Avatar now, but it is, I mean, the kind of numbers that were just really, really rare. It was assumed then that the Rocky series was dead, that Stallone would go on to talk about how he made the film out of greed. He didn't make it for the right reasons and paid a price for that as well. And Stallone would go through bumps off the back of it, that his career would struggle for a few years until he got to 1993 and had the double bill of Cliffhanger and Demolition Man. But that trend that I talked about at the start, when Sylvester Stallone's career just hits a problem or he's struggling or there's something, and you go back to the filmography, you go back to where the Rocky and Rambo films just turned up in his life, he would revive Rocky Balboa for the screen, in the film Rocky Balboa, that would come out in the year 2006. And by the time he did that, he hadn't had a box office hit really in over a decade. The films that he made after Demolition Man through to Rocky Balboa were The Specialist, which is fun, Judge Dredd, Assassins, Daylight, Copland, an Alan Smithy film, The Good Life, Ants, Get Carter, Driven, Detox, Avenging Angelo, Taxi 3, Shade, a supporting role in Spy Kids 3D, and he gambled again on Rocky, a low budget Rocky film, which again he didn't have full control over, as I've talked about on another episode of this podcast. And in 2006 he would do Rocky Balboa, in 2008 he would do Rambo, and they would give him footing back again. The future of the Rocky saga would be handed over to Creed in 2015. I've covered that before on a previous episode of the podcast. Sylvester Stallone retired playing for good, we're led to believe, and I'm inclined to agree. In 2018, the character of Rocky Balboa in Creed 2, in all of the films in the saga to date, it's said that, and it's hard to disagree, that Rocky 5 was the low point. But in the midst of it all, you do think there might just be a few lessons that were learned. And that brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. I've horribly overrun, but if I've not completely bored you, you can find more from me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Simon Brew. You can find more from me on the Film Stories Project on Twitter and Blue Sky at Film Stories, youtube.com/filmstories, facebook.com/filmstoriesonline, Film Stories Magazine UK on Instagram, patreon.com/Simon Brew is the Patreon. And the shop, store.filmstories.co.uk for our print magazines, for our Blu-rays as well. And filmstories.co.uk is where you will find our print film magazines for sale. All the details there. Main thing is, you all look after yourselves and you all stay healthy. I will be back soon with another bunch of film stories. Thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. And you know what? Enjoy your movies. I'll try and find some more nerdy stories about them. Take care. Bye-bye.